And I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun, and behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who were already dead, more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who's never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. Okay, well, the title tonight, Incentives to Work. It sounds like I'm going to be giving an hour-long lecture on economics. I know that. That's not exactly what it's going to be. But, you know, I have to preach what's there. You know, if you look at this, and what's Solomon talking about? I mean, look at verses 4, 5, and 6. What's he talking about? What's the number one thing? I do that whenever I've got, you know, I preach through books, and so what's my main topic? Well, I read the passage, and I say, if I could boil it down to one or two words, what's the main topic, and then what's he saying about that topic? Well, the main topic in verses 4, 5, and 6 is work. He's talking about work. Now, what's he saying about work, and how do we apply what he says about work, and what are all the various ways you can look at what he says about work, and what other verses might you bring in that also shed light on his topic of work? Well, that's what building a sermon is all about, and so that's what we will do tonight. Now, if you were here last week, you might have left thinking, man, that really was just a diatribe against socialism and against abortion. Now, if that is what you left here thinking, I just want to say good job, you were listening well. Because that was a big part of what I was talking about with good cause, because you heard verses 1 through 3 that I just read. And if I boiled 1 through 3 down to one word, it would be oppression. And so I wanted to talk about that. And last time, that's what we talked about, true and false oppression, because in our world today and in our country today, I think oppression is something that is very misunderstood. And to be quite honest, false oppression is used as a political tool by many people to try to further their cause. The most glaring example of that was the little gay fella up in Chicago just this past week who claimed that two white Trump supporters attacked him, put a rope around his neck, poured bleach on him, and said, "Make America great again," all this stuff. It comes out in the last 2 days that this young black gay actor from Chicago that had this horrible thing happen to him, turns out it was actually two of his friends that he paid to do it. And they were from Nigeria on top of that. So when it all comes out, it turns out he had to pay. I saw somebody say, "America's so great, this poor guy had to pay a couple of Nigerians to come over and oppress him." Now when you think about it, was he oppressed? No, he's not oppressed. It was a total fake setup job. Now why did he do it? Because he wanted sympathy. He perhaps wanted to further his career. He's an actor, and this is a thing. He was getting a lot of politicians jumping on, "Oh, support him. We need justice for him. What a rotten country we live in." The whole thing was a hoax. He faked the entire thing. That's exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about false oppression. Because guess what? There really is real oppression out there. And there really are bad things that happen, and when real bad things happen, and you have people like this crying wolf, well, then that when the real bad things happen, people say, "Oh, well, that's probably just crying wolf again." And so he doesn't do anybody any favors with his phony oppression. As I said last time, also, as far as I can tell, by far the most oppressed group on the planet would be babies residing in their mother's womb. The place that you would assume would be the safest place for them to be. And yet America has gone from, you know, abortion in the early stages, first trimester, you know, that was accepted at one point, and it's just mushroomed now to the point where they're literally, some literally have talked about, go ahead, deliver the baby, and then let mom decide whether or not she wants it to live or die, and then kill it. That's oppression. We read that passage last week. On the side of the oppressors is power. Now, if you have power to legally take an innocent life like that, you are an oppressor. And the one being slaughtered is being oppressed. Now, I can't think of any bigger example than that. You say, well, what about the poor? What about this, the downtrodden, this and that and the other? Well, those all might be examples of oppression, assuming that the oppression is because somebody with power is treating them unfairly. If it's the case of other reasons for why they're in that life situation, that doesn't count as oppression. Okay, I don't want to re-preach that whole sermon. I just want to remind you of where we're coming from. And what we talked about last time. Last time I said we were going to talk about, it's going to be political in some ways and philosophical in some ways. And so that was the political part. The philosophical was as Solomon addressed the question of whether it's better to be alive, to be dead, or to have never lived at all. Yeah, that's a deep philosophical question, huh? I wonder which one of those, you know, which one of those would be best. I mean, throughout Ecclesiastes, Solomon is venting in a lot of ways. I've said that numerous times. And he's also speaking after the fact. So he's writing this, back then, this is what I was wrestling with. Okay, and he figures it out by God's grace that the only answer to life is to know God. But as he wrestles with this, he says, you know, I congratulate the dead because they don't have to live and see this. Now, have you not thought that yourself at times when you watch the news? You say, oh, I'm glad so-and-so's gone on. I would hate for them to know how horrible the world's gotten. Solomon pushes the envelope one step further, though, and saying, you know, what's even better is if you never existed. Now, which of those is better? He's speaking purely from a temporal perspective. We should bring the eternal into that, and when we do that, we say, yes, what's best is to live, to be alive, and it is actually better to be dead, not because I just want to escape this rotten world, but because I will depart and be with Christ. Life not only makes sense, but it has its greatest meaning when you know the Lord and follow the Lord and live for the Lord. And apart from that, Solomon is right on the money when he says vanity. It's just vanity. What's the point? And so we carry on tonight getting to verse 4, talking about work, talking about labor. You're going to see some of the same themes. Like I said, if last week seemed like a diatribe on socialism, tonight will seem like more of a cheerleading session on capitalism. I've got good reasons for that. And I believe it's very germane to the text, and I'll get to that and explain exactly what I mean as we try to understand what Solomon says. All right, verse 4 is where we begin, and on your outline, if you have one, ways to work, ways to work. Verse 4, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. King James words it a little differently, and the way the King James words it actually changes the meaning somewhat. And it's one of those passages, as I studied it, it's kind of hard to translate from Hebrew into English and tell exactly what it's meaning. This is what the King James says. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So the slight nuance there between those two translations, the NAS seems to come across as saying a man and his neighbor are at odds with one another, they envy one another, and this is vanity. Indeed, if that's all your life consists of is envying your neighbor and he envies you, that is vanity. The King James kind of presents it as though one of those neighbors is working hard and he's industrious and the other one is envying him. Which I think, I can't speak to the Hebrew text with an expert opinion for sure, but that seems to be a little bit closer to what is being said here. It's not true that every single person on the planet who works, works because they're envious of their neighbor. I don't think Solomon means that, but it does make sense to say you work hard and somebody else is going to envy you. Well, that's just vanity. I mean, that's vain. That's, you know, what's the point? They're missing the point of life if that's all they can do is be jealous of you. you don't be jealous of them. All right, so ways to work, and he mentions two words here, again, from the NAS, every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry. And so I divided this into those two words, labor and skill. What's the significance of those two words? What is labor and skill? Well, labor is the exertion required to get a job done. Whatever that job may be, labor is a term used not only in reference to the workplace, but to the maternity ward as well, right? There's a certain amount of labor. I've not experienced it, only secondhand. I've been there and watched my wife experience that. And I tell you, I'd rather do any type of manual labor for years on end than to go through that once. But that's why God made me a man and not a woman. And so I have the utmost respect for any woman who's gone through that. It looks horrible. And that's just the beginning of the work. Then you got to take care of them after that. So, which is a blessing. Children are a blessing from the Lord. So, all right, labor is the exertion required. And, you know, there's lots of different fields, different types of labor by which man and women, for that matter, work. Manual labor, for example, many jobs involve a lot of manual labor. We see this sometimes described as blue-collar type work or grunt work or entry-level type stuff, and it can be a very good living in some regards, or it can be very motivating to encourage young people to go into other lines of work. Of course, where I grew up in tiny nowhere Oklahoma, most of the work for young, uneducated men like myself when I was still teenage was farm work. And some people love farm work. Some of my classmates still farm up there in my hometown. Farm work was excellent for me, too, in that it motivated me to never work on a farm for the rest of my life. Hauling hay convinced me that I would almost rather do anything. So, be it college, be it a trade, I mean, I did both of those. I'm going to find something other than this. Some people would say, well, why? That's such fulfilling work. Don't you want to be out there? No, I don't. I sure don't. So, God didn't call me to that. He called you to that, then you go do that. But not me. I'm glad they do it. I enjoy the fruit of their labor every day. Three times a day, sometimes five or six times a day, depending on how hungry I am. So, you know, in terms of labor, you got manual labor, you got mental labor, you've got jobs that require a tremendous amount of mental work. I work that type of job now. It requires a tremendous amount of study, and what does this mean, and what does that mean, and bring in this, and bring in that. I have found, having worked both jobs that were extremely mentally taxing versus those that are extremely physically taxing, I'm almost more tired from mental work than I am physical work. Because there's something about physical work that it's almost invigorating. To a point. You get to a point where it's more than I care for, but mental labor, and not just, you know, my line of work. There's lots of lines of work out there that involve mental, strong mental capacity. That's labor, okay? Labor is not just manual labor. There's also mental labor, and to be honest, there's even emotional labor, what you might call it. Any workplace you're in, there are times that your day is emotionally taxing. If you work in a service industry where you're dealing with irate customers all day, boy, that wears on your emotions. Sometimes it's just coworkers that wear on your emotions. And so Solomon, who lives in a world where he's the king, but he's not, you know, a lot of times you picture kings as being detached and they're off, you know, in their throne room drinking wine and, you know, let them eat cake when they don't have any. Type mentality. Solomon's not. He's not detached. I mean, he sees problems out there, and he's bothered by them, and he writes about it. And this is what I pointed out last time for those who think, well, government's the answer for everything. They'll solve every ill. Solomon was the most powerful man on the planet, and he couldn't solve these problems. He was bothered by them, and yeah, he solved some, but he was limited and what he could do. And if Solomon couldn't solve them, I assure you that your government's not going to solve every problem either, and you shouldn't even want them to. They create more problems than they solve, by the way. That's a side note. So, All right, labor. And then the other word he uses here is skill. Now, what is skill? I think King James says right work. Skill's a little more detailed than the word labor. Labor has to do with the exertion that you put forth to get a task done. Skill is what you use your labor to do. In other words, if you are a farmer, for example, well, what you do is you grow crops, okay? That's your labor. What skills do you have to do that? Well, you know how to run a tractor, or you know how to run a combine, and skills like that. And so labor is more than just work. It's also what you do as work. And when you think about that, again, there's all kinds of different types of jobs out there. Look in the Bible, and Jesus, for example, was a carpenter. That was his skill, and it is a skill. There's not everybody that can do that, just like any other job. That's why we have a division of labor. That's good. Everybody's not a carpenter. Everybody's not a farmer. If some of you were farmers, we'd starve to death. If I was a farmer, we'd starve to death. I'm not so good at it. Some people are, you know, carpenters, mechanics, whatever the case might be. Jesus was a carpenter. Peter was a fisherman. Paul was a tent maker. These are the skills that they had. And in our day and age, we've still got jobs like that, and jobs in numerous types of fields, and technical jobs, and trade jobs, and professional jobs, and whatever it is. Solomon's point is, okay, there's all kinds of jobs out there, but what I see a lot of is that it's just rivalry. And if that's all that motivates you, then you're striving after wind. I mean, your life could be a lot more fulfilling than it is. If you're driven by nothing than the fact that I want to destroy my neighbor, I see what he has, and I want more than what he has, and this is a competition, and I'm going to show him up. I mean, if that's really what drives you, then you, regardless of how much you attain in life, you're probably not going to be a very happy person. And that's what Solomon's talking about. And he knows of what he speaks, because there's nobody richer than him on the planet at that time. He has everything he wants. Anything he could possibly want, he could have, and he did. We've talked about this in the past. Everything from gardens to gold to women to wine, song, comedy, you know, make himself laugh. Everything he could do, and he had, you know, plenty of money, and at the end of it all, he was still wanting. He found himself wanting. He was not happy, and so that's what this whole book is really about. And again, as I said, I don't want you to wait till I get done with this book to know the answer. The answer is to know God. Fear God and keep his commandments is what he says. All right, so those are the ways to work, and now we move on to verse 4, the reasons to work. I have seen that every labor, every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. So he mentions primarily rivalry here, but there are some other reasons to work that the Bible gives in other places, and I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't mention some of those. And so I've got others on your outline there, and I'm going to give you some verses for those. Why do you work? What's the point? We do have I hope it's a really small segment, but a growing segment, as I mentioned last time, of socialism in our country, where people are kind of pushing for that. One of the tenets of socialism that some people are pushing, and you're going to hear about this, it's called a universal basic income. What this is, Cortez, the gal up in New York, is pushing this pretty hard. Bernie Sanders pushes it too. A certain amount of money that's given to everybody for absolutely doing absolutely nothing. Just a universal basic income. They don't have to work for it, it's just here. Now, if you're an economist, the number one question you should ask is, who's going to pay for that? Furthermore, if you have a lick of common sense, you don't have to be an economist, you're going to say, who's going to pay for that? The solution I've heard, in all honesty, from one congresswoman up in New York, her solution is, we just print more money. That's how you pay for that. Duh. If you got financial problems, just crank up the printing press. Now, I remember explaining this to little bitty kids years ago. Maybe my own, maybe kids at other, at the school or whatever. Well, if we need more money, why don't we just print money? Well, if you go do that on your own, you're going to wind up in prison for one thing, because that's counterfeiting. But just a basic economic fact, you don't have to be a genius to know this, but the more you flood the market with any particular product, the less value it has. Now, you see this, for example, in communist countries as the economy, as it always does, begins to crumble over the weight of government control. The government cannot really control an economy. You have to kind of trust the consumers to do that. What ends up happening is the currency gets messed up, and it takes a wheelbarrow full of cash to go buy a loaf of bread, if you can find bread, because the government messes up in terms of how much bread should be made, because they get to decide everything. And so when you think of reasons to work, why is it that you do that? And say, well, okay, the government's going to say, you know what, we're going to give everybody a universal basic income. At that point, would you say, okay, cool, I'm never going to work again. Somebody's just going to give me a paycheck. I hope that wouldn't be your answer, because that's not a Christian. That's not a Christian answer. That's not a Christian belief that you would do that. Nor should you support that, by the way. The interesting thing about the universal basic income, it was attached to this thing called a Green New Deal that Congressperson Cortez had espoused up in New York, a green in terms of environmental friendly. These are all the things they want to do to make the world a better place environmentally. They wanted to eliminate airplanes. They wanted to kill cows. They wanted to rebuild every building in America and make it eco-friendly. And one of the things they wanted to do was give everybody a universal basic income. Now, that has nothing to do with environments. So what's that even in a Green New Deal for anyway? Okay, it was basically just a way to push socialism. But the point is, this is not, that doesn't provide an incentive to work. And the Bible does provide incentives to work. That provides incentives for laziness. And in that particular case, the document said on their website that the Green New Deal will provide a basic living income for anyone who is unable or unwilling to work. Unable, okay? Disabled, injured, whatever the case might be. Or unwilling. Why in the world would you provide any income for someone who is flat out unwilling to work? There's nothing Christian about that. And sometimes I hear Christians jumping on that. Oh, it's our job as Christians to take care of these people. It's not our job to take care of people who are too lazy to work. You don't see that in the Bible. Yes, we should take care of the downtrodden and the disabled. And the Bible speaks of widows, for example. The church, not the government coming in and taking everything from people and saying, oh, we'll take care of this. Give us your money. That's not how it works in the Bible. And so you preach through Ecclesiastes and you say, well, you know, how come the Bible's not more practical? I see practical stuff all over this. Okay, so why do you work? Let me give reason number one, if you have your outline there. How about survival? Not so much nowadays, but in times past, if you didn't work, you didn't eat, you didn't live. That's a pretty good incentive. Hunger is a really good incentive to work. This is from the beginning, Genesis chapter 3, verse 17, cursed is the ground because of you. This is, of course, the Lord talking to Adam. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat bread, till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken. Your dust, to dust you shall return. Now, God provides a really good incentive to work there, and he tells him, it's not going to be so fun all the time, all right? You're not going to get to sit around and talk about how unfulfilling your work is. You're going to be too busy trying to keep from dying. That's been human history for most of it. We live in a day and age now where starvation is not anywhere near the problem that it was in generations past, not anywhere near that. And, you know, we should be very thankful for that, by the way. But clearly, one of the motivations given there for work is survival. Again, the Apostle Paul reiterates this in the New Testament, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order, if anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. For we hear that some among you are leading undisciplined lives, doing nothing, no work at all, acting like busybodies. Such persons we command and exhort. Did you catch those words, by the way, that Paul said? Such persons we command. He's not suggesting that they get motivated. He's commanding it. Such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work. Quiet fashion, eat their own bread. Now, you say, are there any conditions to this? Of course there are. I mean, there are some that this would not be talking to. He's not talking about those who are literally, genuinely unable to work, disabled. They cannot work. He's not talking about them. He's not talking about those who are so sick that they cannot. He's not talking about them. Too old, they can't work. He's not talking about them. If you're retired, for example, say you have a pension. What is a pension? It's money that you made while working. You saved up for that time in your life. That's work. That's living off of work. He's not talking about that. He's not talking about homemakers who are working their fingers to the bone in the home, taking care of the family, taking care of the kid. He's not talking about that. He's talking about able-bodied people who will not do anything. And they had it in the early church. And what's so disconcerting about it is they use theological arguments to justify their laziness. Oh, Jesus is coming back. I'm not going to work. I'm not going to, he'll probably be back next week. I'm not going to pay my bills. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to, well, what happens if they start starving to death? Well, you got a whole church full of Christians who are compassionate people. They're like, well, you know, he's an idiot, but I don't want him to starve to death. So I'm going to feed him. And Paul says, if he's not willing to work, he doesn't need to eat. And why does Paul say that? Is Paul mean? No, because Paul knows that hunger is a tremendous motivation for an able-bodied young man to work. Well, I sound like the meanest pastor on the planet, don't I? Anyway, I think what I'm saying is straight from the scriptures, though. So, okay, so survival, that's a reason to work. I hope you won't think me a capitalistic pig if I say this, but another reason to work? Make money. Making money is a good reason to work. It's a good incentive. Does your employer pay you? Okay, well then, I must not be too far off base. One of the most misquoted verses in the Bible. Money is the root of all evil. That's not what the Bible says. That's right. 1 Timothy 6:10 says, the love of money is the root of all different kinds of evil. Well, that's a good one that people will take out, destroy, and, I mean, they'll put you on a guilt trip over that. That's not what the verse says. It's not even what the verse means. It's a warning. Hey, money can easily enslave you. I mean, you can get too obsessed with it. You can love it. And if you love it, it can ruin your life. The pursuit of it can ruin your life. But money in and of itself is not a bad thing. That's a good incentive to work. And I've never encouraged someone to go out and get a job and ask the employer not to pay them. I mean, that's greedy of you to ask for a salary. I mean, you should work at the plant for free. Well, what kind of logic is that? Well, it's bad logic. Did you know Jesus had money? He carried a money box when the disciples and him were going around. Now, there was a crook in charge of it, okay? Judas was in charge of it. But why did Jesus carry a money box? Because they had expenses. They had things they had to pay for. I strongly suspect when he was a carpenter, he got paid for his work as well. I'm pretty sure because Joseph was a carpenter, and they probably worked together. And Joseph, I know for a fact from Scripture, was required to pay taxes. Well, because he worked. All right, so survival, and underneath that, I would say making money is a very good incentive to work. Now, it all depends on what you do with the money as to whether or not it's good or bad. For example, let me throw this name on you. Everybody hisses when they hear this name, but hear me out. You ever heard of the name Rockefeller? Now that money, or that name is synonymous with money, right? I say that all the time. What do you think we are, Rockefellers? Well, John D. Rockefeller didn't even used to be a Rockefeller in the financial sense. He started out poor. And when he came about and came a business, of course, he's famous for Standard Oil was the company that he was the head of. Well, he started out as a bookkeeper. He didn't have any money and kind of worked his way up, bought into a couple of oil wells in the early days, and he did one thing after another. And he became the richest man on the planet. In modern-day dollars, he was easily a billionaire. But not only did he have the most money on the planet, did you know at the time he also gave away the most money on the planet at that time? Many of the things that you enjoy today came about because of some of the things he started, some of the money that he gave. And did you know he was a devout Baptist? Not just Christian either. He was a devout Christian Baptist. And he was adamant about that. He and his wife both. When they first started dating, the only dates he would take her on were church events. He wouldn't take her to the theater. He didn't believe in that. He was a teetotaler. No card playing. You know, he was old school. Church events, and that was it. And she was fine with that because that's all she wanted to go to as well. Devout Baptist. And once he started making his millions, billions, if you will, he started giving away vast portions of it. And originally, he would only give to Baptist causes that had a gospel connection to them. He didn't just give money to whoever wanted it or even to any charity, even if they were good charities. If it was not a Baptist cause with a gospel intent, he would not give money to it. Now, there's a lot of schools around this country. In fact, there's one 20 miles from where I grew up, Bacone College in Oklahoma. It originally started as a school for Cherokee Indians to learn how to read and write, completely funded by John D. Rockefeller. A Baptist Cherokee Indian school, I should say. It's not anymore, but that's how it started. So anytime you're watching things, and funding for this was provided by the John D. Rockefeller Foundation. They have given money to all sorts of things. Now you might say, well, what happened? They give to a lot of things now that aren't so great, and not Baptist and not Christian. What happened was eventually kids and grandkids came along and they didn't share Grandpa's views on where the money should go. They were a little more liberalized, and today a lot of the Rockefeller family is very liberal. But the original one was not. He made a lot of money, and he gave away a lot of money. So it depends on what you do with it in terms of making it. All right, reasons to work. Survival, making money would fall under that. Fulfillment, this is a good reason to work, and this is something that Solomon has addressed also. Back in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 12, we discussed this a few weeks back. He says, I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. And so it is a gift from God to find fulfillment in your labor. And it's one of those things, interestingly enough, you can find a certain amount of fulfillment no matter what job you're doing, you know, assuming it's reputable, legal, moral jobs, things of that nature. But it's really the idea of finding fulfillment in your work is a modern-day phenomenon. I mean, historically, people were not thinking about fulfillment. They were thinking about survival. And what you did for a living pretty much depended on what your dad did for a living, and it depended on where you lived. And you didn't get a whole lot of say in that. Think of the prodigal son, the story there, right? I mean, he's going to take his inheritance. He's going to go out and live wild living. He squanders everything, and now he's starving. And you remember the job he ends up with? He's slopping hogs. He's Jewish. He's slopping hogs. I hope you realize the connection there. That's not a good job for a Jew. But you think he was sitting around thinking, I need to find something more fulfilling. I need to take one of those personality tests or something. I need to go to the local career center and see if there's something else I can do, you know, customer service or something like that. I mean, when it comes to being fulfilled or having your stomach filled, well, usually having your stomach filled wins the day, and that's how it was for him. went back to his dad and said, hey, just give me a job as lowest on the totem pole and I'll be eternally grateful. And of course, dad welcomes him with open arms. It's obviously a picture of salvation. All right, survival, fulfillment, that's a good motivation for work. Rivalry is mentioned here, specifically by Solomon, rivalry between a man and his neighbor. And so as we look at this, the thing to consider here, is rivalry a good thing or a bad thing? Now, there's a difference, for example, between motivation, which is a good thing, and coveting, which is a bad thing. And that's what I want to address here. I think very clearly he's talking about rivalry in the sense of coveting or in the sense of just wanting to destroy your neighbor as something that is worthless. It's vanity. It's chasing after the wind. Now, when it comes to motivation versus coveting, what is coveting? Well, coveting is when you see what your neighbor has and you want it. It's not, oh, that's a nice truck. I'd like to have one like that. Where'd you buy that thing? Or even, it's not even to say, I like that truck of yours. Would you sell it to me? That's not coveting either. Coveting is to say, I want that truck, and I'm going to get it. Coveting is closely related to thievery. I mean, that's the unfortunate byproduct, I guess you would say, conclusion of coveting. It leads to thievery. And there are some things you can't have, right? I mean, the Bible also speaks of coveting in the sense of coveting your neighbor's wife. She's not for sale unless her husband's a really, really bad capitalist. So you've got coveting, but then you've also got motivation. I want something like what my neighbor has. That's a good thing. I mean, motivation is a good thing. Coveting in the sense of, well, I'm going to keep up with the Joneses, that's a bad thing. I mean, if you're living your life so you can impress other people, I mean, that's a trap. I love what Dave Ramsey, the financial guru, says about that, keeping up with the Joneses. He says, basically, that entails spending money you don't have to buy things you don't need so you can impress people you don't even really like. That's a large measure what that is all about. All right, so he speaks of a rivalry between a man and his neighbor, and this too is vanity, verse 4, and striving after wind. And the idea of rivalry there, if what drives you is merely a desire to destroy someone else, then that's a bad motivation for work. That's not what should drive you to get up in the morning. I want to destroy that person. This division, envy. And I talked about this last time with the whole push towards socialism. That's what that is rooted in, is getting people fighting with each other, rivalry. I'm more oppressed than you. No, you're more oppressed. You oppressed me. No, I oppressed. And they just get each other at each other's throats. And then the benevolent government steps in and says, I'll solve all your problems. And they end up being your biggest problem by far in such situations. All right, so he talks about rivalry, and now one other thing here I want to mention under reasons to work, competition, which would be rivalry in a sense on a grand scale, on a corporate scale, if you will. Economically speaking, when you think of competition between businesses, for example, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? That is an extremely good thing. I hope you realize what a good thing competition is between businesses, what we might call free markets. If you have a desire to be the best at what you do and to make capital, which is to say make money, at the end of the day, that's good for everyone. You hear so many attacks on capitalism today. Oh, it's evil. It makes people rich. It makes people greedy. It makes people this. It makes people... Hey, people are greedy under any economic system. People are rich under any economic system. People are poor under any economic system. What you have to look at is what is the foundational kernel of the system? What is it rooted in? What motivates it? Socialism, the foundational kernel of it is government control. They will control the economy and tell you what you can have. Capitalism, the foundational kernel is free market liberty. You decide what you want to buy. Now, in situations like that, by the way, who decides what companies win and what companies lose? Under socialism, the government decides. Under capitalism, you decide. The consumer decides. With every dollar you spend, you vote for the company you want to win. I like it better that way, personally. because it's more in line with liberty. Now, when you think of something like competition and within a capitalistic system, the reason it's good for the consumer is because when you have two people competing for your business, what are they prone to do? Make a better product at a cheaper price so they can compete with the other company. When you think, many of you, strangely enough, came here tonight in an automobile. You can afford an automobile? Some of you have more than one. Don't let anybody know this, but I have more than one. I'm a preacher. I'm not supposed to have more than one. I have more than one. They're old, but hey, they're good. Point being, when those things first came out, nobody could afford them except the wealthy. But Henry Ford became a millionaire, and he didn't become a millionaire by producing cars that nobody could actually afford to buy. He had to start changing the way he was making things so that he could get the price down because he wanted everybody to be able to buy them. Why? Because he's a nice guy? Part of it in his case, I think, really was that he wanted to provide, where the common man could buy a car. Part of it, yes, part of it was also profit-related. And that's not a bad thing to make money. Do you know how many people he employed? And a lot of times, this is interesting, he's a greedy capitalist pig, Henry Ford. Oh, he was one of those titans from the, all he cared about was money. You know, in a day and age when the average American worker made about $1 a day, Henry Ford introduced the $5 work day for every one of his employees. He said, well, I had $5 a day. Well, back in those days, that was a bunch. He introduced that for every one of his employees. And so, you can call him a greedy pig all you want, but he was doing more for the country than most of the people griping around calling him a greedy pig. Here's a quote from him. I will build a car for the great multitude. It'll be large enough for the family, but small enough for the individual to run and care for. It will be constructed of the best materials by the best men to be hired, simplest designs that modern engineering can devise, but it will be so low in price that no man making a good salary will be unable to own one and enjoy with his family the blessings of hours of pleasure in God's great open spaces. You almost want to applaud that capitalistic thought, don't you? God's great open spaces. When the Model T came out in 1908, it cost $825. Which in modern-day dollars, that would be about $23,000. You could swing it, maybe a little steep for the common man. He kept making them Model Ts, and you know what he did? He figured out that instead of having one guy build an entire car, he would create what's called an assembly line, where this guy does wheels all day, this guy puts engines in, this guy puts doors on, and he dramatically increased the amount he could produce, and he cut his cost in the process while raising wages, strangely enough. Why? Because he was selling way more cars. Started off 1908, $825 for a Model T. By 1924, it was $265. Modern day dollars, that would be $3,800. How would you like to buy a brand new car for $3,800? Sam says, I'll take one. I might take five. Now, what did that? Competition did that. It drove the prices down over the course of time. Why? I mean, part of it, I think Henry Ford really did want to produce a car that the common man could drive. But guess what? There was a guy named Billy Durant who started a company called General Motors, and he said, guess what? I can build a car better than his and cheaper. And these two brothers named Dodge had the same idea. You see what I'm saying? And then Cadillac and Lincoln said, you know what, I'm not going to compete with a Model T. I think there's a market out there for people who will pay a little bit more for a nicer car. Don't you like having all those options? That's capitalism. That's competition. You live in a socialistic country, you don't get those options. The government decides how many cars, what kind of cars, how much money you're allowed to have, and if you're allowed to buy one or not. And even if you buy one, you may not be able to put gas in it. Unless the government decides, and it's available. All right. So that's competition in a capitalistic system and why it's good. One final quote on that. This is from Joseph Schumpeter, an old-time economist. He said, Queen Elizabeth owned silk stockings. The capitalist achievement does not consist in providing more silk stockings for the queen, but in bringing them within reach of the factory girl. That's what happens. When you have competition, it drives prices down, and things that when they first come out, you ever notice things are way up here expensive, and it doesn't take long before, well, I can actually afford a car. I can actually afford a television. I can actually afford these things. That's what capitalism, that's what competition does. All right, so when he speaks of rivalry, there's a good thing and a bad thing. If all you're focused in is a personal rivalry to destroy somebody else, that's a bad thing. But competition in business is a good thing. And that has to do with reasons to work. Now let's go to number three, which I'm going to try to get done tonight. Avoidance of work. You might say, if you're sitting there right now and you say, I'm tired of hearing about all this economy stuff. I'm just not going to work at all. What's the point? You say that lady up in New York's going to give me money anyway, so what's the point? Well, take a look at this if you're a Christian. He doesn't speak well of that mindset. Verse 5, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. That's a powerful statement if you really unpack it. Laziness is foolishness, according to that verse. And it's not just saying lazy is bad. He's saying laziness consumes your own flesh. You're destroying yourself by laziness. I immediately thought of a verse, Proverbs 6, which speaks of the ant. You're familiar with that. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 6, go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways, which having no chief, officer, ruler, prepares her food in the summer, gathers her provision in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. I knew a guy in college. When he went off to college, his father wrote that verse out and taped it on the wall right next to his bed. That's a good dad. How long will you rest? How long will you sleep, O sluggard? All right, so that's the other option. If you're not going to work, then you're going to do verse 5. You're going to fold your hands and consume your own flesh. Consuming your own flesh is not a good thing. It's destructive. And finally, verse 6, I think, it hits on what we're shooting for, which is moderation in work. No, you shouldn't love money. Making money is a good thing, but loving money is a bad thing. And no, you shouldn't be so obsessed with work that it consumes you. And no, you shouldn't go to the other extreme and fold your hands and consume your own flesh. Look what verse 6 says. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that one verse. One hand full of rest. Now, if there's one hand full of rest, what's the other hand full of? Probably work. I mean, I think that's the point here. Moderation. You rest, you work. It's better than what? Two fists full of labor. So two fists full of labor would imply all you do is work. And it's striving after wind, he says. Now, the verse before that says you fold your hands and do nothing with them. Well, that's consuming your own flesh. So do you want to strive after wind with two fists full of labor, or do you want to consume your own flesh with two hands folded doing nothing? Door number 3 says one hand full of rest, one hand full of work, which would speak of moderation, a well-balanced life, if you will. There are times in which you're going to work way more than you wish you had to, but that's just the way it is. The old expression where I come from, you make hay while the sun shines. You ever heard that one? Well, when the sun's shining, you better be making hay because you ain't going to be doing it while it's raining. And that's just how it is sometimes. Occasionally when people will say to me, I'm sorry, I got called into work. I understand how the work world works. You don't got to give me a note from your boss proving you missed church because you went to work. I commend work. I wouldn't say you do that every service for the rest of your life and never attend church again. See, that would be two fists full of labor striving after wind. Well, balance is what you're going for. And let's look at Jesus in conclusion on this. What did Jesus say about work, for example? John chapter 9, verse 4, we must work the work of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no man may worketh. He's speaking of doing the works of God there, his Father, but he's also speaking of the fact that you're not always going to be able to work. You better work while you can. Furthermore, John chapter 5, verse 16, the Jews were persecuting Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath? He answered them and said, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. Jesus thought highly of work. Jesus also mentions rest. Mark chapter 6, verse 31, he said to the disciples, come away by yourselves to a secluded place and rest a while. For there were many people coming and going. They did not even have time to eat. And they went away in the boat to a secluded place by themselves. I think you'll remember one of the most dramatic stories in the Bible, a storm out on the sea with the disciples, and Jesus is resting, isn't he? He's sleeping. Sleeping so soundly, the storm's not even waking him up. And so Jesus speaks well of work, and he speaks well of rest. Two fists full of labor is striving after the wind. All right, so conclusion. Work should not be your God. It should not be your idol. But work should not be a neglected afterthought either. There should be moderation in it. Be motivated without coveting. Make money without loving money. Rest at times, but don't become lazy. Work hard, but don't become obsessed with work. And I think a good summation for everything you do in life, work, your views on economics, your views on anything else. Keep this in mind, and I'll close with this. 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Make that your goal, and everything else falls into place.